Robin suddenly remembered that she'd heard this from Brian Tucker, back at the Star Cafe. She hadn't yet heard back from the Ministry of Justice about the possibility of interviewing Creed, and as Strike still had no inkling what she was up to, she said, "Think I read it online." But with a new heaviness pressing on her heart, Robin remembered that Kara's only remaining close relative, the brother she'd raised, had drunk himself to death. Hutchins had said the police weren't able to do anything about that film. Kara Wolfson's body might be anywhere. Some stories didn't have neat endings. There was nowhere to lay flowers for Kara Wolfson, unless it was on the corner near the strip joint, where she'd last been seen. Fighting the depression now threatening to overwhelm her, Robin raised her phone to show Strike what she'd been looking up, and said in a determinedly matter-of-fact voice, "I was just reading about somnophilia, otherwise known as sleeping princess syndrome."
"Which, I take it,
was Brenner's kink," said Robin, and reading off her phone she said, "Somnophilia is a paraphilia in which the individual is sexually aroused by someone non-responsive. Some psychologists have linked somnophilia with necrophilia. Cormoran, you know how he had barbiturates stocked up in his office?"
"Yeah," said Strike slowly, as they walked back towards his car. "Well, this is going to give us something to talk to Dorothy's son about, isn't it? I wonder whether she was game for playing dead, or whether she found herself sleeping a long time after Brenner had been round for lunch."
Robin gave a small shudder.
"I know," Strike continued, as he lit up. "I said he'd be a last resort, but we've only got 3 months left. I'm starting to think I'm going to have to pay Mucky Ricci a visit."
Chapter 57. But all his mind is set on Mucky Pelf, to hoard up heaps of evil-gotten mass, for which he others wrongs and wrecks himself. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Adding daytime surveillance of St. Peter's Roman Catholic Nursing Home to the rota meant that as May progressed, the agency was again struggling to cover all open cases. Strike wanted to know how many visitors were going in and out, and at what times, so that he might ascertain when he'd have the best chance of entering the building without running into one of the old gangster's relatives. The nursing home lay in a quiet Georgian street on the very edge of Clerkenwell, in a quiet, leafy enclave where dun-coloured brick houses sported neoclassical pediments and glossy black front doors. A dark wood plaque on the exterior wall of the nursing home was embellished with a cross and a biblical quotation in gold. "For you know that it was not with perishable things such as silver or gold that you were redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your ancestors, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect." Peter 1:18-19.
"Nice sentiment," a Strike commented to Robin on one of their handovers, "but nobody's getting in there without a good bit of cash."
The private nursing home was small and clearly expensive. The staff, all of whom the agency quickly grew to know by sight, wore dark blue scrubs and hailed mostly from abroad. There was a black male nurse who sounded as though he'd come from Trinidad, and two blondes who talked Polish to each other every morning as they passed whichever agency member happened to be loitering in the area at the time, feigning a call on their mobile, reading a newspaper, or appearing to wait, slightly impatiently, for a friend who never showed up. A podiatrist and a hairdresser went regularly in and out of the home, but after 2 weeks' daytime surveillance, the agency tentatively concluded that Ricci only received visits on Sundays when his two sons appeared, wearing the resigned looks of people for whom this was an unwelcome chore. It was easy to identify which brother was which from pictures that had appeared in the press. Luca looked, in Barclay's phrase, "like a piano fell on his head," having a bald, flat, noticeably scarred skull. Marco was smaller, slighter, and hairier, but gave off an air of barely contained violence, slamming his hand repeatedly on the nursing home's doorbell if the door wasn't opened immediately, and slapping a grandson round the back of the head for dropping a chocolate bar on the pavement. Both the brothers' wives had a hard-boiled look about them, and none of the family had the good looks Robin associated with Italians. The great-grandfather sitting mutely behind the doors of the nursing home might have been a true Latin, but his descendants were disappointingly pallid and Saxon in appearance, right down to the little ginger-haired boy who dropped his chocolate. It was Robin who first laid eyes on Ricci himself. On the third Saturday, the agency was watching the home. Beneath her raincoat, Robin was wearing a dress, because she was meeting Strike later at the Stafford Hotel in Mayfair to interview C.B. Oakden. Robin, who'd never been to the hotel, had looked it up and learned that the five-star establishment, with its bowler-hatted doormen, was one of the oldest and smartest hotels in London, hence her atypical choice of surveillance wear. As she'd previously disguised herself while lurking outside St. Peter's, alternately beanie hat, hair up, dark contact lenses and sunglasses, she felt safe to look like herself for once as she strolled up and down the street, pretending to talk on the phone, although she'd added clear-lensed glasses she'd removed for the Stafford. The elderly residents of St. Peter's were occasionally escorted or wheeled down the street in the afternoon to the nearby square, which had a central private garden enclosed by railings, open only to keyholders, there to doze or enjoy the lilac and pansies while well wrapped up against the cold. Hitherto, the agency had seen only elderly women taken on the outings, but today, for the first time, an old man was among the group coming down a ramp at the side of the building. Robin recognized Ricci instantly, not by his lion ring, which, if he was wearing it, was well hidden beneath a tartan rug, but by the profile that time might have exaggerated, but could not disguise. His thick black hair was now dark grey, and his nose and earlobes enormous. The large eyes that reminded Strike of a basset hound had an even more pronounced droop these days. Rich's mouth hung slightly open as one of the Polish nurses pushed him towards the square, talking to him brightly, but receiving no response.
"You are right, Enid, love,"
the black male nurse called ahead to a frail-looking old lady wearing a sheepskin hat, and she laughed and nodded. Robin gave the group a head start, then followed, watching as one of the nurses unlocked the gate to the garden, and the party disappeared inside. Walking around the square with her phone clamped to her ear, pretending to be in conversation, Robin thought how typical it was that today, of all days, she'd worn heels, never imagining that there might have been a possibility of approaching Ricci and chatting to him. The group from the nursing home had come to a halt beside flower beds of purple and yellow. Ricci parked in his wheelchair beside an empty park bench. The nurses chatted amongst themselves and to those old ladies capable of doing so, while the old man stared vacantly across the lawns. If she'd been wearing her usual trainers, Robin thought, she might possibly have been able to scale the railings and get into the garden unseen. There was a clump of trees that would provide cover from the nurses, and she could have sidled over to Ricci and found out, at the very least, whether he had dementia. Unfortunately, she had absolutely no chance of managing that feat in her dress and high heels. As she completed her walk around the square, Robin spotted Saul Morris walking towards her. Morris was early, as he always tended to be, whenever it was Robin from whom he was taking over. "He's gone to mention either the glasses or the heels first," Robin thought.
"High heels,"
said Morris, as soon as he was within earshot, his bright blue eyes sweeping over her.
"Don't think I've ever seen you in heels before. Funny. I never think of you as tall, but you are, aren't you? Sexy specs, too."
Before Robin could stop him, he'd stooped and kissed her on the cheek.
"I'm the guy you're meeting on a blind date," he told her,
straightening up again and winking. "How do we account for the fact that I'm about to leave you standing here?" Robin asked, unsmiling, and Morris laughed too hard, just as he did at Strike's mildest jokes.
"Dunno. What would it take to make you walk out on a blind date?"
asked Morris. "You turning up," thought Robin. But ignoring the question, she checked her watch and said,
"If you're okay to take over now, I'll head..." "Here they come," said Morris quietly. "Oh, the old fella's outside this time, is he? I wondered why you'd abandon the front door."
The comment aggravated Robin almost as much as his flirtatious manner. Why did he think she'd leave the front door unless the target had moved? Nevertheless, she waited beside him while the small group of nurses and residents, having decided that 20 minutes was enough fresh air, passed them on the other side of the street, heading back to the home.
"My kids were taken out like that at nursery," said Morris quietly, watching the group pass. all bundled up in pushchairs, the helpers wheeling them out. Some of that lot are probably wearing nappies, too, he said, his bright blue eyes following the St. Peter's party.
Christ, I hope I never end up like that.
Ricci's the only man, too, poor sod. I think they're very well looked after, Robin said, as the Trinidadian nurse shouted, Up we go in it!
Like being a kid again, though, isn't it? Said Morris, as they watched the wheelchairs rolling along in procession. But with none of the perks.
Suppose so, said Robin. I'll head off then, if you're ready to take over.
Yeah, no problem, said Morris,
but he immediately added,
Where you going, all dressed up like that?
I'm meeting Strike.
Oh, said Morris, eyebrows raised.
I see.
No, said Robin, you don't. We're interviewing someone at a really smart hotel.
Ah,
said Morris. Sorry.
But there was a strange complacency, bordering on complicity, about the way Morris bade her goodbye, and it wasn't until Robin had reached the end of the street that the unwelcome thought occurred to her that Morris had entirely misread the sharpness of her denial that she was going on a date with Strike, that he might, in fact, have interpreted it as Robin wanting to make it quite clear that her affections weren't engaged elsewhere. Was Morris, could he be, so deluded as to think that Robin was secretly hoping that his unsubtle flirtation might lead to something happening between them? Even after what had happened on Boxing Day, when she'd shouted at him for sending her that dick pic. Little though she wanted to believe it, she was afraid that the answer was yes. Morris had been extremely drunk when she'd shouted at him, and possibly incapable of judging just how truly angry and disgusted she'd been. He'd seemed sincerely ashamed of himself in the immediate aftermath, so she'd forced herself to be friendlier than she wanted to be, purely out of a desire to foster team cohesion. The result had been that Morris had returned to his pre-dick pic ways. She only answered his late-night texts, mostly containing jokes and attempts at banter, to stop him pestering her with, Have I offended you follow-ups? Now it occurred to her that what she considered professionalism, Morris took as encouragement. Everything he said to her about work suggested that he saw her as less able and less experienced than the rest of the agency. Perhaps he also thought her naive enough to be flattered by the attentions of a man she actually found condescending and slimy. Morris, Robin thought, as she headed towards the tube, didn't actually like women. He desired them, but that, of course, was an entirely different matter. Robin, who was forever marked by the ineradicable memory of the man in the gorilla mask, knew better than most that desire and liking were different, and sometimes mutually exclusive things. Morris gave himself away constantly, not only in the way he spoke to Robin, but in his desire to call Mrs. Smith rich bitch, his attribution of venal or provocative motives to every woman under surveillance, in the barely disguised disgust with which he noted that Mucky Ricci was now forced to live in a house full of females.
Christ, I hope I never end up like that.
Robin walked another few steps, and suddenly stopped dead, earning herself a curious glance from a passing traffic warden. She'd had an idea, triggered by what Morris had just said to her, or rather, the idea had slammed its way into the forefront of her mind, and she knew that it had been there in her subconscious all along, waiting for her to admit it. Moving aside so as not to get in the way of passers-by, Robin pulled out her phone and checked the list of paraphilias she'd last consulted when looking up sleeping princess syndrome. Autonepiophilia.
Oh, God, Robin muttered. That's it. That's got to be it.
Robin called Strike, but his number went to voicemail. He was doubtless already on the tube, heading for the Stafford. After a moment or two's thought, she called Barclay.
Hiya, said the Scot. Are you still outside Eleanor Dean's?
Yeah.
Is there anyone in there with her?
No.
Sam, I think I know what she's doing for those men.
What?
Robin told him. The only answer was a long silence. Finally, Barclay said,
You're off your head, Robin.
Maybe, said Robin. But the only way to know for sure is to knock on the door and ask if she'll do it for you. Say you were recommended to her by S.B.
Will I fuck? Said Barclay. Does Strike know you're asking me to do this?
Sam, we've got a week left before the client pulls the plug. The worst that can happen is that she denies it. We're not going to have many more chances.
She heard Barclay exhale, hard.
All right, but it's on ye if you're wrong.
Robin hurried onwards towards the tube station, second-guessing herself as she went. Would Strike think she was wrong to tell Barclay to go in, on her hunch? But they had a week left before the client withdrew funding. What was there now to lose? It was Saturday evening, and Robin arrived on the crowded tube platform to find she'd just missed a train. By the time she exited at Green Park Station, she'd lost the chance of arriving at the American Bar early, which she'd hoped to do, so that she and Strike would have a few words together before Oakden arrived. Worse still, when she hurried down St. James's Street, she saw, with a sense of déjà vu, a large crowd blocking the bottom of the road, being marshalled by police. As Robin slowed down, wondering whether she'd be able to get through the dense mass of people to the Stafford, a couple of sprinting paparazzi overtook her, in pursuit of a series of black Mercedes. As Robin watched them pressing their lenses against windows, she became aware that the crowd in the distance was chanting, "Johnny! Johnny!" Through the windows of one of the cars heading towards the event, Robin glimpsed a woman in a Marie Antoinette wig. Only when she was nearly knocked sideways by a sprinting pair of autograph hunters, both of them holding Deadbeats posters, did Robin realize with a thrill of shock that Strike's father was the Johnny whose name was being chanted.
"Shit!"
she said aloud, wheeling around and hurrying back up the road, pulling out her mobile as she went. She knew there was another entrance to the Stafford via Green Park. Not only was she going to be late, but a horrible suspicion had just hit her. Why had Oakden been so determined to meet on this specific evening? And why had it had to be this bar, so close to what she was afraid was an event involving Strike's father? Did Strike know, had he realized, what was happening close by? She called him, but he didn't pick up. Still walking, she typed out a text. "Cormoran, I don't know whether you know this, but Johnny Ropeby's having an event around the corner. I think it's possible Oakden's trying to set you up." Breaking into a jog, because she was already 5 minutes late, she knew she'd just told Strike, for the very first time, that she knew who his father was. On her arrival in Green Park, she saw from a distance a policeman at the rear entrance, who, with one of the hotel's bowler-hatted attendants, was politely but firmly turning away two men with long-lensed cameras.
"Not this way, sorry," said the policeman. "Only for tonight. If it's the hotel you want, you'll have to go round the front." "What's going on?"
demanded a suited man, hand in hand with a beautiful Asian woman in a Cheong Sam.
"We've got a dinner booking. Why can't we go through?"
"Very sorry, sir, but there's an event on at Spencer House," explained the doorman, "and the police want us to stop people using this as a shortcut."
The two men with cameras swore and turned away, jogging back the way Robin had come. She lowered her head as they passed her, glad that she was still wearing her unneeded glasses, because her picture had appeared in the press during a court case a couple of years back. Maybe she was being paranoid, but Robin was worried the pressmen had been trying to use the Stafford not as a shortcut to Ropeby and his guests, but as a means of getting to his estranged son. Now that the photographers had gone, the bowler-hatted attendant permitted the woman in the Cheong Sam and her companion to enter, and after giving Robin a shrewd up-and-down glance, evidently decided she wasn't a photographer and allowed her to proceed through the gate into a courtyard where well-dressed drinkers were smoking beneath exterior heaters. After checking her mobile and seeing that Strike hadn't answered her text, she hurried up the steps into the American Bar. It was a comfortable, elegant space of dark wood and leather, with pennants and baseball caps from many American states and universities hanging from the ceiling. Robin immediately spotted Strike standing in a suit at the bar, his surly expression lit by the rows of illuminated bottles on the wall.
"Cormoran, if you're about to tell me my father's just round the corner," said Strike tersely, "I know. This arsehole doesn't realize I'm wise to his attempted setup yet."
Robin glanced into the far corner. Carl Oakden was sitting there, legs spread wide, an arm along the back of the leather bench. He was wearing a suit, but no tie, and his attitude was clearly meant to suggest a man at ease in these cosmopolitan surroundings. With his slightly too close-together eyes and his narrow forehead, He still resembled the boy who'd smashed Roy's mother's crystal bowl all those years ago.
"Go and talk to him. He wants some food. I'm getting menus," muttered Strike. "We just got started on Steve Douthwaite. Apparently Dorothy's always thought the bloke was suspicious."
Heading towards Oakden, Robin prayed that Strike was going to keep his temper. She'd only once seen him lose his cool with a witness and had no desire to see it happen again. "Mr. Oakden," she said, smiling, as she reached him and extending her hand, "I'm Robin Ellicott. We've emailed."
"I know," said Oakden, turning his head slowly to look her up and down with a smirk.
He ignored her outstretched hand, and Robin could tell he did so deliberately. Refusing to show that she realized that he was trying to be offensive, she shrugged off her raincoat.
"Nice bar," she said pleasantly, sitting down opposite him. "I've never been here before."
"Normally takes you to cheaper places, does he?" asked Oakden.
"Cormoran was just telling me you remember your mother talking about Steve Douth."
"Love," said Oakden, legs still wide apart, arm along the back of the leather bench. "I told you all along. I'm not interested in being palmed off with assistants or secretaries. I'll talk to him or nobody."
"I'm actually Cormoran's..."
"I'll bet you are," said Oakden, with a snigger. "Don't suppose he can get rid of you now, can he?"
"Sorry?"
"Not now you've been knifed trying to do a man's job," said Oakden, with a glance towards her forearm as he raised his cocktail to his lips. "You'd probably sue the shit out of him if he tried." Oakden, who'd evidently done his homework on the detectives, was clearly reveling in his rudeness. Robin could only suppose that the con man assumed she was too desperate for his information to take offence at his manner. He seemed determined to derive maximum pleasure from this encounter, to enjoy free alcohol and food, and bait a woman who was unlikely to walk away. Robin wondered which paper or picture agency he'd contacted to propose luring Strike within a few hundred yards of his father's party, and how much Oakden stood to gain if they could get a picture of Strike apparently publicly snubbing his father, or catch the detective on record saying something angry and quotable.
"There you go," said Strike, throwing a couple of leather-bound menus onto the table and sitting down.
He hadn't thought to bring Robin anything to drink. Oakden picked up a menu and perused it slowly, and he seemed to enjoy keeping them waiting.
"I'll have the club sandwich," he said at last, and Strike hailed a waiter.
The order given, Strike turned back to Oakden and said,
"Yeah, so you were saying your mother found Douthwaite." "Oh, she definitely thought he was a charmer," said Oakden.
His eyes, Robin noted, kept moving to the entrance of the bar, and she was sure Oakden was waiting for photographers to burst in.
"Wide boy, you know the type, chatting up the slags on reception. The old woman said he tried it on with everyone. The nurse got all giggly when he was around and all."
Robin remembered the gambling black skeleton of Talbot's notebook and the words written beside Crowley's figure of death. "Fortuna says Pallas Athena, Ceres, Vesta and Cetus are scarlet women who ride upon the beast."
"And did your mother think he fancied Dr. Bamborough?"
Oakden took a sip of his cocktail and smacked his lips.
"Well, I mean Margot," he said, with a small snort of laughter,
and Robin found herself irrationally resentful of Oakden using the missing doctor's first name.
"You know, she was the classic wanted it all ways, wasn't she?" "What ways were those?" said Strike. "Bunny girl," said Oakden, taking another sip of his drink. "Legs out, tits out. Then quick, get the white coat on." "Don't think GPs wear white coats," said Strike. "I'm talking metaphorically," said Oakden airily. "Child of her time, wasn't she?" "How's that?"
"The rise of gynocentric society," said Oakden, with a slight bow towards Robin, who suddenly thought his narrow head resembled a stoat's.
"Late '60s, early '70s, it's when it all started changing, isn't it? You've got the pill, consequence-free fucking. Looks like it benefits the male, but by enabling women to avoid or subvert the reproductive function, you're repressing natural and healthy patterns of sex behaviour. You've got a gynocentric court system, which favours the female, even if she didn't want the kids in the first place. You've got a misandrist authoritarianism, masquerading as a campaign for equal rights, policing men's thoughts and speech and natural behaviour. And you've got widespread sexual exploitation of men. Playboy Club, that's all bullshit. Look but don't touch. It's the old courtly love lie. The woman's there to be worshipped, the man's there to spew cash but never get satisfaction. Suckers, the men who hang around those places. "Bamborough didn't look after her own kid," said Oakden, his eyes again darting to the entrance and back to Strike. "Didn't fuck her own husband, from what I heard. He was nearly always too ill to perform. He had plenty of cash, though, so she gets a nanny and goes lording it over men at work."
"Who, specifically, did she lord it over?" asked Strike.
"Well, Douthwaite ran out of there practically crying last time he saw her," my old woman said. "But that's been our culture since the 60s, hasn't it? Male suffering, nobody gives a shit. People whine when men break, when they can't handle it any more, when they lash out. If Douthwaite did her in, I don't personally think he did," said Oakden, with an expansive gesture, and Robin reminded herself that Carl Oakden had almost certainly never laid eyes on Stephen Douthwaite, and that he'd been 14 years old when Margot disappeared. "But if he did, I'd lay odds it's because she kicked his pain back in his teeth." "Only women bleed," said Oakden, with a contemptuous little laugh. "Isn't that right?" he shot at Robin. "Ah, there's my sandwich." While the waiter served him, Robin got up and headed to the bar, where the beautiful woman in a Cheong Sam, whose hair hung like black silk in the light of the banked bottles of spirits, was standing with her partner. Both were ordering cocktails and looked delighted to be in each other's company. For a few seconds, Robin suddenly wondered whether she'd ever again feel as they did. Her job reminded her almost daily of the many ways in which men and women could hurt each other. As she ordered herself a tonic water, Robin's phone rang. Hoping it was Barclay, she instead saw her mother's name. Perhaps Linda had got wind of Sarah's pregnancy. Matthew might have taken his wife-to-be back to Masham by now to share the good news. Robin muted the phone, paid for her drink, wishing it was alcoholic, and carried it back to the table in time to hear Oakden say to Strike, "No, that didn't happen." "You didn't add vodka to the punch at Dr. Bamborough's barbecue." Oakden took a large bite of his free sandwich and chewed it insolently. In spite of his thin hair and the many wrinkles around his eyes, Robin could clearly see the spoiled teenager inside the 54-year-old.
"Nick some," said Oakden thickly, then drank it in the shed. "Surprised they missed it, but the rich are tight. How they stay minted, isn't it?" "We heard the punch made someone sick."
"Not my fault," said Oakden.
"Dr. Phipps was pretty annoyed, I hear."
"Him," said Oakden, with a smirk. "Things worked out all right for old Phipps, didn't they?"
"In what way?" asked Strike.
"Wife out the way, marrying the nanny. All very convenient."
"Didn't like Phipps, did you?" said Strike. "That came across in your book."
"You've read it," said Oakden, momentarily startled.
"How come?" "Managed to track down an advance copy," said Strike. "It should have come out in 85, right?"
"Yeah," said Oakden.
"Do you remember the gazebo that was under construction in the garden when the barbecue happened?"
One of Oakden's eyes flickered. He raised a hand quickly to his face and made a sweep of his forehead, as though he felt a hair tickling him.
"No," he said. "It's in the background of one of your photos. They just started building the columns. I expect they'd already put down the floor."
"I can't remember that," said Oakden.
"The shed where you took the vodka wasn't near there then."
"Can't have been," said Oakden.
"While we're on the subject of nicking things," said Strike, "would you happen to have the obituary of Dr. Brenner you took from Janice Beattie's house?"
"I never stole no obituary from her house," said Oakden, with a display of disdain.
"What would I want that for?" "To get some information you could try and pass off as your own."
"I don't need to look up old Joe Brenner. I know plenty about him. He came round our house for his dinner every other Sunday. My old woman used to cook better than his sister, apparently."
"Go on, then," said Strike, his tone becoming combative. "Amaze us."
Oakden raised his sparse eyebrows. He chewed another bite of sandwich and swallowed it before saying,
"Hey, this was all your idea. You don't want the information? I'm happy to go." "Unless you've got more than you put in your book. Brenner wanted Margot Bamborough struck off the bloody medical register. Come round our house one Sunday full of it, couple of weeks before she disappeared." "There," said Oakden pugnaciously. "I kept that out of the book because my mother didn't want it in there."
"Why was that?"
"Still loyal to him,"
said Oakden, with a little snort of laughter. "And I wanted to keep the old dear happy at the time, because noises had been made about writing me out of the will. Old women," said the convicted con man, "are a bit too persuadable if you don't keep an eye on them. She got chummy with a local vicar by the 80s. I was worried it was all going to go to rebuild the bloody church steeple unless I kept an eye on her. Why did Brenner want Bamborough struck off? She examined some kid without parental permission. Was this Janice's son?" asked Robin. "Was I talking to you?" Oakden shot at her. "You," growled Strike, "want to keep a civil tongue in your bloody head. Was it Janice's son, yes or no?"
"Maybe," said Oakden. And Robin concluded that he couldn't remember.
"Point is, that's unethical behaviour, looking at a kid without a parent there. And old Joe was all worked up about it. 'I'll have her struck off for this,' he kept saying. There. Didn't get that from no obituary, did I?"
Oakden drank the rest of his cocktail straight off, then said, "I'll have another one of those." Strike ignored this, saying,
"And this was 2 weeks before Bamborough disappeared."
"About that, yeah. Never seen the old bastard so excited. He loved disciplining people, old Joe.
Vicious old bastard, actually."
"In what way?"
"Told my old woman in front of me she wasn't hitting me enough," said Oakden. "She bloody listened, too. Tried to lay about me with a slipper a couple of days later, silly cow. She learned not to do that again."
"Yeah? Hit her back, did you?"
Oakden's two close together eyes raked Strike, as though trying to ascertain whether he was worth educating. "If my father had lived, he'd have had the right to punish me. But her trying to humiliate me because Brenner told her to, I wasn't taking that."
"Exactly how close were your mother and Brenner?"
Oakden's thin brows contracted.
"Doctor and secretary, that's all.
There wasn't anything else between them, if that's what you're implying."
"They didn't have a little lie down after lunch, then," said Strike. "She didn't come over sleepy after Brenner had come over."
"You don't want to judge everyone's mother by yours," said Oakden. Strike acknowledged the jibe with a dark smile and said, "Did your mother ask Brenner to sign the death certificate for your grandmother?"
"The hell's that got to do with anything?"
"Did she?"
"I don't know,"
said Oakden, his eyes darting once again towards the bar's entrance.
"Where did you get that idea? What are you even asking that for?"
"Your grandmother's doctor was Margot Bamborough, right?"
"I don't know," said Oakden.
"You can remember every word your mother told you about Steve Douthwaite, right down to him flirting with receptionists and looking tearful the last time he left the surgery, but you can't remember details of your own grandmother falling downstairs and killing herself."
"I wasn't there," said Oakden. "I was out at a mate's house when it happened. Come home and seen the ambulance."
"Just your mother at home, then?"
"The hell's this relevant to what's the name of the mate whose house you were at?" asked Strike, for the first time taking out his notebook.
"What are you doing?" said Oakden, with an attempt at a laugh, dropping the last portion of his sandwich on his plate. "What are you fucking implying?"
"You don't want to give us his name."
"Why the fuck should—"
"He was a schoolmate. Convenient for you and your mother, old Maud falling downstairs," said Strike.
"My information is she shouldn't have been trying to navigate stairs alone in her condition."
"Inherited the house, didn't you?"
Oakden began to shake his head very slowly, as though marvelling at the unexpected stupidity of Cormoran and Strike.
"Seriously, you're trying to—"
"Well, well. Not going to tell me the name of your school friend, then?"
"Wow," said Oakden, attempting a laugh. "You think you can drop a word in a friendly journalist's ear to the effect that your long career of screwing over old ladies started with a good hard push in the small of your grandmother's back? Oh, yeah, I definitely can. Now you wait a fucking—"
"I know you think it's me being set up tonight," said Strike, leaning in. His body language was unmistakably menacing, and out of the corner of her eye, Robin saw the black-haired woman in a Cheong Sam and her partner watching warily, both with their drinks at their lips. "But the police have still got a note written to them in 1985, telling them to dig beneath the cross of St. John. DNA techniques have moved on a lot since then. I expect they'll be able to get a good match from the saliva under the envelope flap."
Oakden's eyelid twitched again.
You thought you were going to stir up a bit of press interest in the Bamborough case, to get people interested in your shitty book, didn't you? I'm warning you. You go talking to the papers about me and my father, or about me working the Bamborough case, and I'll make sure you get nailed for that note. And if by chance that doesn't work, I'll put my whole agency onto turning over every part of your miserable fucking life until I've got something else on you to take to the police. Understand? Oakden, who looked momentarily unnerved, recovered himself quickly. He even managed another little laugh.
You can't stop me writing about whatever I want. That's freedom of...
I'm warning you, repeated Strike, a little more loudly. What'll happen if you get in the way of this case? And you can pay for your own fucking sandwich.
Strike stood up, and Robin, caught off guard, hastened to grab her raincoat and get up too.
Cormoran, let's go out the back, she said, thinking of the two photographers lurking at the front of the building. But they hadn't gone more than two steps when they heard Oakden call after them.
You think I'm scared of your fucking agency? Some fucking detective you are, he said.
And now most of the heads in their vicinity turned. Glancing back, Robin saw that Oakden had got up too. He'd come out from behind the table and was planted in the middle of the bar, clearly set on making a scene.
Strike, please, let's just go, said Robin, who now had a presentiment of real trouble.
Oakden was clearly determined to come out of the encounter with something sellable, or at the very least, a narrative in which he'd come out on top. But Strike had already turned back towards their interviewee.
You didn't even know your own fucking father's having a party round the corner, said Oakden loudly, pointing in the direction of Spencer House. Not going to pop in, thank him for fucking your mother on a pile of beanbags while 50 people watched.
Robin watched what she had dreaded unfold in apparent slow motion. Strike lunged for Oakden. She made a grab for the arm Strike had drawn back for a punch, but too late. His elbow slammed into Robin's forehead, breaking her glasses in two. Dark spots popped in front of Robin's eyes, and the next thing she knew, she'd fallen backwards onto the floor. Robin's attempted intervention had given the con man a few seconds in which to dodge, and instead of receiving what might have been a knockout punch, he suffered no worse than a glancing blow to the ear. Meanwhile, the enraged Strike, who'd barely registered his arm being impeded, realized what he'd done only when he saw drinkers all over the bar jumping to their feet, their eyes on the floor behind him. Turning, he saw Robin lying there, her hands over her face, a trickle of blood issuing from her nose.
Shit! Strike bellowed.
The young barman had run out from behind the bar. Oakden was shouting something about assault. Still slightly dizzy, tears of pain streaming from her eyes, the humiliated Robin was assisted back onto her feet by a couple of affluent-looking grey-haired Americans who were fussing about getting her a doctor.
"I'm absolutely fine," she heard herself saying.
She'd taken the full force of Strike's elbow between her eyebrows, and she realized her nose was bleeding only when she accidentally sprayed blood onto the kind American's white shirt front.
"Robin, shit,"
Strike was saying.
"Sir, I'm going to have to... Yes, we're absolutely going to leave,"
Robin told the waiter, absurdly polite, while her eyes watered and she tried to stem the bleeding from her nostrils.
"I just need... Oh, thank you so much," she said to the American woman, who'd handed Robin her raincoat.
"Call the police!"
Oakden was shouting. Thanks to Robin's intervention, he was entirely unmarked.
"Someone call the bloody police!"
"I won't be pressing charges," Robin said to nobody in particular.
"Robin, I'm so..."
Grabbing a handful of Strike's sleeve, warm blood still trickling down onto her chin, Robin muttered,
"Let's just go."
She trod on the cracked lens of her glasses as they headed out of the silent bar, the drinkers staring after them. Chapter 58. His lovely words, her seemed due recompense of all her past pains. One loving hour for many years of sorrow can dispense. A dram of sweet is worth a pound of sour. She has forgot how many, a woeful stour for him she late endured. She speaks no more of past. Before her stands her knight, for whom she toiled so sore. Edmund Spenser, The Faerie Queen.
Robin, don't tell me I shouldn't have tried to stop you, she said through gritted teeth, as they hurried through the outside courtyard. Her vision was blurred with tears of pain. Smokers turned to gape as she passed, trying to staunch her bleeding nose. If that punch had connected, we'd be back there waiting for the police. To Robin's relief, there were no paparazzi waiting for them as they headed into Green Park, but she was scared that it wouldn't take long, after the scene Strike had just made, for them to come hunting again.
We'll get a cab, said Strike, who was currently consumed with a mixture of total mortification and rage against Oakden, his father, the press, and himself.
Listen, you're right. I know I'm right, thanks, she said, a little wildly. Not only was her face throbbing, she was now wondering why Strike hadn't warned her about Ropeby's party, why, in fact, he'd let himself get lured there by a second-rate chancer like Oakden, careless of consequences for their case and for the agency.
Taxi!
Bellowed Strike, so loudly that Robin jumped. Somewhere nearby, she heard running footsteps. A black cab pulled up, and Strike pushed Robin inside.
Denmark Street,
he yelled at the cabbie, and Robin heard the shouts of photographers as the taxi sped up again.
It's all right, said Strike, twisting to look out of the back window. They're on foot. Robin, I'm so fucking sorry.
She pulled a mirror out of her bag to try and clean up her smarting face, wiping blood from her upper lip and chin. It looked as though she was going to have two black eyes. Both were rapidly swelling.
Do you want me to take you home? Said Strike.
Furious at him, fighting the urge to cry out of pain, Robin imagined Mac's surprise and curiosity at seeing her in this state, imagined having to make light again of the injuries she'd sustained while working for the agency. She also remembered that she hadn't gone food shopping in days.
No. I want you to give me something to eat and a strong drink. You've got it, said Strike, glad to have a chance to make reparations. Will a takeaway do?
No, said Robin sarcastically, pointing at her rapidly blackening eyes. I'd like to go to the Ritz, please. Strike started to laugh, but cut himself off, appalled at the state of her face.
Maybe we should go to casualty. Don't be ridiculous. Robin,
you're sorry, I know, you said. Strike's phone rang. He glanced down. Barclay could wait, he decided, and muted it. 3/4 of an hour later, the taxi dropped them at the end of Denmark Street, with a takeaway curry and a couple of clinking bottles. Once upstairs, Robin repaired to the toilet on the landing, where she washed dried blood from her nostrils and chin with a wad of wet toilet paper. Two increasingly swollen, red-purplish mounds containing her eyes looked back at her out of the cracked mirror. A blue bruise was spreading over her forehead. Inside the office, Strike, who'd normally have eaten the curry straight out of the foil tray it had come in, had brought out mismatched plates, knives and forks. Then, because Robin wanted a strong drink, went upstairs to his flat, where he had a bottle of his favourite whiskey. There was a small freezer compartment in his fridge, where he kept ice packs for his stump, in addition to an ice tray. The cubes within this had been there for over a year, because although Strike enjoyed the odd drink of spirits, he generally preferred beer. About to leave the flat with the ice tray, he had second thoughts and doubled back for one of the ice packs as well. Thank you, muttered Robin, when Strike reappeared, accepting the proffered ice pack. She was sitting in Pat's seat behind the desk where she'd once answered the phone, where Strike had laid out the curry and plates. And you better redo next week's rota, she added, applying the ice pack gingerly to her left eye first, because there isn't a concealer in the world that's going to cover up this mess. I'm not going to have much chance of going unnoticed on surveillance with two black eyes.
Robin, said Strike yet again, I'm so fucking sorry. I was a tit, I just... What do you want, vodka? Whiskey?
Whiskey, she said, on the rocks. Strike poured both of them a triple measure.
I'm sorry, he said yet again, while Robin took a welcome gulp of scotch, then began helping herself to curry.
Strike sat down on the fake leather sofa opposite the desk.
Hurting you's the last thing. There's no excuse for... I saw red, I lost it. My father's other kids have been pestering me for months to go to that fucking party, said Strike, running his hand through the thick, curly hair that never looked disarranged.
He felt she was owed the whole story now,
the reason, if not the excuse, that he'd fucked up so badly. They wanted us to get a group photo taken for a present. Then Al tells me Rokeby's got prostate cancer, which doesn't seem to have prevented him having 400 mates over for a good old knees-up. I ripped up the invitation without registering where the thing was being held. I should have realized Oakden was up to something. I took my eye off the ball and... He downed half his drink in one. There's no excuse for trying to punch him, but everything, these last few months... Rokeby rang me in February, first time ever. Tried to bribe me into meeting him.
He tried to bribe you, said Robin, pressing the ice back to her other eye, remembering the shouted, go fuck yourself, from the inner office on Valentine's Day.
As good as, said Strike. He said he was open to suggestions for helping me out. Well, it's 40 years too fucking late for that.
Strike downed the rest of his whiskey, reached for the bottle, and poured the same again into his glass.
When did you last see him? Robin asked.
When I was 18. I've met him twice, Strike said. First time was when I was a kid. My mother tried to ambush him with me outside a recording studio.
He'd only ever told Charlotte this. Her family was at least as dysfunctional and peculiar as his own, riven with scenes that to other people might have been epoch-defining. It was a month before Daddy torched Mummy's portrait in the hall, and the panelling caught fire, and the fire brigade came, and we all had to be evacuated via the upstairs windows. But the Campbells were so normalised, they seemed routine.
I thought he wanted to see me, said Strike.
The shock of what he'd done to Robin, and the whisky scorching his throat, had liberated memories he usually kept locked up tight inside him.
I was 7. I was so fucking excited. I wanted to look smart so he'd be proud of me. Told my mum to put me in my best trousers. We got outside his studio. My mother had music industry contacts. Someone had tipped her off he was going to be there. And they wouldn't let us in. I thought there'd been a mistake. The bloke on the door obviously didn't realise my dad wanted to see me.
Strike drank again. The curry lay cooling between them.
My mother kicked off. They were threatening her when the band's manager got out of his car behind us. He knew who my mother was, and he didn't want a public scene. He took us inside, into a room away from the studio.
The manager tried to tell her it was a dumb move, turning up. If she wanted more money, she should go through lawyers.
That's when I realized my father hadn't invited us at all. She was just trying to force her way in. I started crying, said Strike roughly. Just wanted to go. And then... While my mother and Rokeby's manager are going at it hammer and tongs, Rokeby walks in. He heard shouting on the way back from the bathroom. Probably just done a line. I realised that later. He was already wound up when he came into the room. And I tried to smile, said Strike. Snot all over my face. I didn't want him to think I was a whiner. I'd been imagining a hug. There you are at last. But he looked at me like I was nothing. Some fan's kid in 2 short trousers. My trousers were always too fucking short. I grew too fast. Then he clocked my mother, and he twigged. They started rowing. I can't remember everything they said. I was a kid. The gist was, how dare she butt in? She had his lawyer's contact details. He was paying enough. It was her problem if she pissed it all away. And then he said, this was a fucking accident. I thought he meant, he'd come to the studio accidentally or something. But then he looked at me, and I realised he meant me. I was the accident.
Oh, God, Cormoran,
said Robin quietly.
Well, said Strike, you've got to give him points for honesty. He walked out. We went home. For a while afterwards, I held out a bit of hope he'd regretted what he'd said. It was hard to let go of the idea he wanted to see me deep down. But nothing.
While the sun was far from setting, the room was becoming steadily darker. The high buildings of Denmark Street cast the outer office into shadow at this time of the evening, and neither detective had turned on the interior lights.
Second time we met, said Strike. I made an appointment with his management. I was 18, just got into Oxford. We hadn't touched any of Rokeby's money for years.
They'd been back to court to put restrictions on what my mother could do with it, because she was a nightmare with cash, just threw it away. Anyway, unbeknownst to me, my aunt and uncle had informed Rokeby I'd got into Oxford. My mother got a letter saying he had no obligations to me now I'd turned 18, but reminding her I could use the money that had been accumulating in the bank account. I arranged to see him at his manager's office. He was there with his long-time lawyer, Peter Gillespie. Got a smile off Rokeby this time. Well, I was off his hands financially now, but old enough to talk to the press. Oxford had clearly been a bit of a shock to him. He'd probably hoped, with a background like mine, I'd slide quietly out of sight forever. He congratulated me on getting into Oxford and said I had a nice little nest egg all built up now, because my mother hadn't spent any of it for 6-7 years. I told him, said Strike, to stick his fucking money up his arse and set fire to it. Then I walked out. Self-righteous little prick I was. Didn't occur to me that Ted and Joan were going to have to stump up if Rokeby didn't, which is what they did. I only realised that later. But I didn't take their money long. After my mother died, midway through my second year, I left Oxford and enlisted.
Didn't he contact you after your mum died? Asked Robin quietly.
No, said Strike. Or if he did, I never got it. He sent me a note when my leg got blown off. I'll bet that put the fear of God into him, hearing I'd been blown up. Probably worried sick about what the press might make of it all. Once I was out of Selly Oak, he tried to give me the money again. He'd found out I was trying to start the agency. Charlotte's friends knew a couple of his kids, which is how he got wind of it. Robin felt something flip in her stomach at the sound of Charlotte's name. Strike so rarely acknowledged her existence. I said no, at first. I didn't want to take the money. But no other fucker wanted to lend a one-legged ex-soldier without a house or any savings enough money to set up a detective agency. I told his prick of a lawyer I'd take just enough money to start the agency and pay it back in installments, which I did.
That money was yours all along, said Robin, who could remember Gillespie pressing Strike for repayments every few weeks when she'd first joined the agency.
Yeah, but I didn't want it. Resented even having to borrow a bit of it.
Gillespie acted as though...
You get people like Gillespie around the rich and famous, said Strike. His whole ego was invested in being my father's enforcer. The bastard was half in love with my old man, or with his fame, I don't know. I was pretty blunt on the phone about what I thought about Rokeby, and Gillespie couldn't forgive it. I'd insisted on a loan agreement between us, and Gillespie was going to hold me to it, to punish me for telling him exactly what I thought of the pair of them.
Strike pushed himself off the sofa, which made its usual farting noises as he did so, and began helping himself to curry. When they both had full plates, he went to fetch 2 glasses of water. He'd already got through a third of the whisky.
Cormoran, said Robin, once he was settled back on the sofa and had started eating. You do realise I'm never going to gossip about your father to other people. I'm not going to talk to you about him if you don't want to, but... We're partners. You could have told me he was hassling you and let off steam that way, instead of punching a witness.
Strike chewed some of his chicken Jalfrezi, swallowed, then said quietly, Yeah, I know.
Robin ate a bit of naan. Her bruised face was aching less now. The ice pack and the whiskey had both numbed her in different ways. Nevertheless, it took a minute to marshal the courage to say, I saw Charlotte's been hospitalised. Strike looked up at her. He knew, of course, that Robin was well aware who Charlotte was. 4 years previously, he'd got almost too drunk to walk and told her a lot more than he'd ever meant to about the alleged pregnancy Charlotte had insisted was his, which had broken them apart forever.
Yeah, said Strike.
And he told Robin the story of the farewell text messages and his dash to the public payphone, and how he'd listened until they'd found Charlotte lying in undergrowth in the grounds of her expensive clinic.
Oh, my Christ, said Robin, setting down her fork. When did you know she was alive?
Knew for sure 2 days later when the press reported it, said Strike.
He heaved himself back out of his chair, topped up Robin's whiskey, then poured himself more before sitting back down again.
But I concluded she must be alive before that. Bad news travels faster than good.
There was a long silence, in which Robin hoped to hear more about how being drawn into Charlotte's suicide attempt, and by the sounds of it, saving her life, had made him feel. But Strike said nothing, merely eating his curry.
"Well," said Robin at last, "again, in future, maybe we could try that talking thing, before you die of a stress-induced heart attack or, you know, end up killing someone we need to question."
Strike grinned ruefully.
"Yeah, we could try that, I suppose."
Silence closed around them again, a silence that seemed to the slightly drunk to thicken like honey, comforting and sweet, but slightly dangerous if you sank too far into it. Full of whiskey, contrition, and a powerful feeling he preferred at all times not to dwell upon, he wanted to make some kind of statement about Robin's kindness and her tact, but all the words that occurred to him seemed clumsy and unserviceable. He wanted to express something of the truth, but the truth was dangerous. How could he say, "Look, I've tried not to fancy you since you first took off your coat in this office. I try not to give names to what I feel for you, because I already know it's too much. And I want peace from the shit that love brings in its wake. I want to be alone, and unburdened, and free. But I don't want you to be with anyone else. I don't want some other bastard to persuade you into a second marriage. I like knowing the possibilities there for us to, maybe. Except it'll go wrong, of course. Because it always goes wrong. Because if I were the type for permanence, I'd already be married. And when it goes wrong, I'll lose you for good. And this thing we've built together, which is literally the only good part of my life, my vocation, my pride, my greatest achievement, will be forever fucked, because I won't find anyone I enjoy running things with, the way I enjoy running them with you. And everything afterwards will be tainted by the memory of you." If only she could come inside his head and see what was there, Strike thought. She'd understand that she occupied a unique place in his thoughts and in his affections. He felt he owed her that information, but was afraid that saying it might move this conversation into territory from which it would be difficult to retreat. But, from second to second, sitting here, now with more than half a bottle of neat whiskey inside him, a different spirit seemed to move inside him, asking himself for the first time whether determined solitude was what he really wanted forevermore.
"Joni reckons you're going to end up with your business partner, that Robin girl."
All or nothing, see what happens. Except that the stakes involved in making any kind of move would be the highest of his life. Higher by far than when he'd staggered across a student party to chat up Charlotte Campbell, when, however much agony he'd endured for her later, he'd risked nothing more than minor humiliation and a good story to tell. Robin, who'd eaten as much curry as she could handle, had now resigned herself to not hearing what Strike felt for Charlotte. She supposed it had been a forlorn hope, but it was something she was very keen to know. The neat whiskey she'd drunk had given the night a slight fuzziness, like a rain haze, and she felt slightly wistful. She knew that if it hadn't been for the alcohol, she might feel simply unhappy.
"I suppose," said Strike, with the fatalistic daring of a trapeze artist, swinging out into the spotlight, only black air beneath him, "Isla's been trying to matchmate your end as well."
Across the room, sitting in shadow, Robin experienced something like an electric shock through her body. That Strike would even allude to a third party's idea of them being romantically involved was unprecedented. Didn't they always act as though nothing of the sort could be further from anyone's mind? Hadn't they always pretended certain dangerous moments had never happened, such as when she'd modelled that green dress for him and hugged him while wearing her wedding dress, and felt the idea of running away together pass through his mind as well as hers?
"Yes," she said at last. "I've been worried, well, embarrassed about it, because I haven't..."
"No," said Strike quickly. "I never thought you were..."
She waited for him to say something else, suddenly acutely aware, as she'd never been before, that a bed lay directly above them, barely 2 minutes from where they sat. And, like Strike, she thought, everything I've worked and sacrificed for is in jeopardy if I take this conversation to the wrong place. Our relationship will be forever marred by awkwardness and embarrassment. But worse than that, by far, she was scared of giving herself away. The feelings she'd been denying to Matthew, to her mother, to Isla, and to herself, must remain hidden.
"Well, sorry," said Strike.
What did that mean, Robin wondered, her heart thumping very hard. She took another large gulp of whiskey before she said, "Why are you apologizing? You're not..."
"She's my friend."
"She's mine too now," said Robin. "I don't think she can help herself. She sees two friends of the opposite sex getting on."
"Yeah," said Strike, all antennae now. Was that all they were? Friends of the opposite sex?
Not wanting to leave the subject of men and women, he said,
"You never told me how mediation went. How come he settled after dragging it out all this time?"
"Sarah's pregnant. They want to get married before she has it, or before she gets too big for a designer dress, knowing Sarah."
"Shit," said Strike quietly,
wondering how upset she was. He couldn't read her tone or see her clearly. The office was now full of shadow, but he didn't want to turn on the lights.
Did you expect that?"
"Suppose I should have," said Robin, with a smile Strike couldn't see, but which hurt her bruised face. She was probably getting annoyed with the way he was dragging out our divorce. When he was about to end their affair, she'd left an earring in our bed for me to find. Probably getting worried he wasn't going to propose, so she forgot to take her pill. "It's the one way women can control men, isn't it?" she said, momentarily forgetting Charlotte and the baby she claimed to have lost. "I've got a feeling she just told him she was pregnant when he cancelled mediation the first time. Matthew said it was an accident. Maybe he didn't want to have it when she first told him."
"Do you want kids?" Strike asked Robin.
"I used to think so," said Robin slowly. "Back when I thought Matthew and I were, you know, forever." As she said it, memories of old imaginings came to her, of a family group that had never existed, but which had once seemed quite vivid to her. The night that Matthew had proposed, she'd formed a clear mental picture of the pair of them with three children, a compromise between his family, where there had been two children, and her own, which had had four. She'd seen it all quite clearly. Matthew cheering on a young son who was learning to play rugby, as he'd done himself. Matthew watching his own little girl on stage, playing Mary in the school nativity play. It struck her now how very conventional her imaginings had been, and how much Matthew's expectations had become her own. Sitting here in the darkness with Strike, Robin thought that Matthew would, in fact, be a very good father to the kind of child he'd be expecting. In other words, a little boy who wanted to play rugby, or a little girl who wanted to dance in a tutu. He'd carry their pictures around in his wallet. He'd get involved at their schools. He'd hug them when they needed it. He'd care about their homework. He wasn't devoid of kindness. He felt guilty when he did wrong. It was simply that what Matthew considered right was so heavily coloured by what other people did, what other people considered acceptable and desirable. "But I don't know anymore," said Robin, after a short pause. "I can't see myself having kids while doing this job. I think I'd be torn, and I don't ever want to be torn again. Matthew was always trying to guilt me out of this career. I didn't earn enough, I worked too many hours, I took too many risks. But I love it," said Robin, with a trace of fierceness, "and I don't want to apologize for that anymore." "What about you?" she asked Strike. "Do you want children?"
"Nope," said Strike. Robin laughed. "What's funny?"
"I give a whole soul-searching speech on the subject, and you're just, no."
"I shouldn't be here, should I?" said Strike, out of the darkness. "I'm an accident. I'm not inclined to perpetuate the mistake."
There was a pause, then Robin said with asperity, "Strike, that's just bloody self-indulgent."
"Why?" said Strike, startled into a laugh.
When he'd said the same to Charlotte, she'd both understood and agreed with him. Early in her teens, her drunken mother had told Charlotte she'd considered aborting her.
Because, for God's sake, you can't let your whole life be coloured by the circumstances of your conception. If everyone who was conceived accidentally stopped having kids,
we'd all be better off, wouldn't we? Said Strike robustly. The world's overpopulated as it is. Anyway, none of the kids I know make me particularly keen to have me own.
You like Jack?
I do, but that's one kid out of God knows how many. Dave Polworth's kids. You know who Polworth is?
Your best mate, said Robin.
He's my oldest mate, Strike corrected her. My best mate?
For a split second, he wondered whether he was going to say it. But the whiskey had lifted the guard he usually kept upon himself. Why not say it? Why not let go?
Is you.
Robin was so amazed she couldn't speak. Never in 4 years had Strike come close to telling her what she was to him. Fondness had had to be deduced from offhand comments, small kindnesses, awkward silences, or gestures forced from him under stress. She'd only once before felt as she did now, and the unexpected gift that had engendered the feeling had been a sapphire and diamond ring, which she'd left behind when she walked out on the man who'd given it to her. She wanted to make some kind of return, but for a moment or two, her throat felt too constricted.
Well, the feeling's mutual, she said, trying not to sound too happy.
Over on the sofa, Strike dimly registered that somebody was on the metal staircase below their floor. Sometimes the graphic designer in the office beneath worked late. Mostly, Strike was savouring the pleasure it had given him to hear Robin return his declaration of affection. And now, full of whiskey, he remembered holding her on the stairs at her wedding. This was the closest they'd come to that moment in nearly 2 years, and the air seemed thick with unspoken things, and again, he felt as though he stood on a small platform, ready to swing out into the unknown.
Leave it there, said the surly self that coveted a solitary attic space and freedom and peace. Now, breathed the flickering demon the whiskey had unleashed.
And like Robin, a few minutes previously, Strike was conscious that they were sitting mere feet from a double bed. Footsteps reached the landing outside the glass outer door. Before either Strike or Robin could react, it had opened.
"It's a power out,"
said Barclay, and he flicked on the light. After a moment, in which the three blinked at each other in surprise, Barclay said,
"You're a friggin' genius, the fuck happened to your face?"
Chapter 59. The warlike Britoness, with such uncouth welcome, did receive her feigned paramour, her forced guest, that being forced his saddle soon to leave, himself he did of his new love deceive, and made himself then ample of his folly, which done, she passed forth, not taking leave, and left him now as sad as Willem Jolly, well warm to beware with whom he dared to dally. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Blinking in the bright light, Robin reached again for the ice pack.
Strike hit me. Accidentally.
Jesus, said Barclay. Wouldn't I want to see what you could do deliberately? How'd that happen?
My face got in the way of his elbow, said Robin.
Said Barclay, hungrily eyeing the almost empty curry cartons.
What was that? Compensation?
Exactly, said Robin.
That way neither of you's been answering your phones for the last 3 hours.
Shit. Sorry, Sam, said Robin, pulling out her mobile and looking at it.
She had 15 missed calls from Barclay since muting her mother in the American bar. She was also pleased to see that she'd missed a couple of texts from Morris, one of which seemed to have a picture attached.
Be on the call of duty to come in person, said the slightly drunk Strike.
He wasn't sure whether he was more glad or annoyed that Barclay had interrupted, but on balance, he thought annoyance was uppermost.
The wife's at her mother's with a bairn overnight, said Barclay, so I thought I'd come deliver the good news in person.
He helped himself to a poppadom and sat down on the arm of the sofa at the other end to Strike.
I've found out what SB gets up to in Stoke Newington. All down to Robin. You ready for this?
What? Said Strike, looking between Barclay and Robin.
When?
Earlier, said Robin, before I met you.
Rang the doorbell, said Barclay. Said I'd been recommended by SB, wondering whether she could help me out. She didn't believe me. I had to get a foot in the door to stop her slamming it on me. Then she says, SB told her a Scottish guy talked him down off Tower Bridge the other day. So, I decided it's cut her losses time, said Barclay. I said, yeah, that was me, I'm a friend. We know what you're up to in here. You're going to want to talk to me if you care about your client. So she let me in.
Barclay ate a bit of poppadom.
Sorry, starving. Anyway, she takes me into the back room, and there it all is.
Where what all is?
Giant playpen she's knocked up out of some foam and MDF, said Barclay, grinning. Big old changing mat, stack of adult nappies, Johnson's baby powder.
Strike appeared to have been struck momentarily speechless. Robin began to laugh, but stopped quickly, because it made her face hurt.
Poor old SB gets off on being a babby. She's only got one other client, that guy at the gym. Doesn't need any more, because SB pays her so much. She dresses them up, changes them, powders their fucking arses.
You're having a laugh, said Strike. This can't be real.
It is real, said Robin, with the ice pack pressed to her face. It's called... Hang on.
She brought up the list of paraphilias on her phone again.
Autonepiophilia, being aroused by the thought of oneself as an infant. Oh, the hell did you...
I was watching the old people being wheeled out of the nursing home, said Robin. Morris said they were like kids, that some of them were probably wearing nappies and it just clicked. I saw her buying a ton of baby powder and dummies in the supermarket, but we've never once seen a child go in or out of that house. Then there was that patting on the head business, like the men were little kids.
Strike remembered following the gym manager home, the man's hand over his lower face as he left Eleanor Dean's house, as though he'd had something protruding from his mouth that he wanted to conceal.
And big boxes being delivered of something really light, Robin was saying.
That'll be the adult nappies, said Barclay. Anyway, she's no bad woman. Made me a cup of tea. She kens about the blackmail. But there's something interesting. She and SB don't think Shifty knows what's really going on inside that house.
How come?
The gym manager let it slip to Shifty. He knew a big man at Shifty's company. SB and the gym guy sometimes go in the playpen together, see? Like it's a nurser.
Barclay suddenly broke into peals of laughter, and Strike followed suit. Robin pressed the ice back to her face and joined in. For a minute, all three of them roared with laughter at the mental image of the two men in nappies sitting in their MDF playpen.
Like it's a nursery, said Barclay in a falsetto, wiping tears out of his eyes. Fuck me, takes all sorts, eh? Anyway, the tit at the gym let this slip, and Shifty, knowing old SB never went to a gym in his life, and that he lives on the other side of London, probes a wee bit, and notices the other guy getting uncomfortable. So, Shifty follows SB, watches him going in and out Eleanor's place, draws the obvious conclusion. She's a hooker. Shifty then walks into SB's office, closes the door, gives him Eleanor's address, and says he kens what's going on in there. SB was shitting himself, but he's no fool. He reckons Shifty thinks it's just straight sex, but he's worried Shifty might do more digging. See, SB found Eleanor online, advertising her services in some dark corner of the net. SB's scared Shifty'll go looking for what she really does if he denies it's sex. And if anyone finds out what really goes on in there, SB's going to be straight back up Tower Bridge. So that bit's not so funny, said Barclay, more soberly. The guy at the gym only came clean to SB and Eleanor a couple of months ago about talking to Shifty. He's about ready to kill himself for what he's done. Eleanor has taken her ad down. But the internet never forgets. So that's no bloody use. The worst thing, Eleanor says, is Shifty himself is a right cock. SB's told her all about him. Apparently, Shifty takes his coke habit to work and is always feeling up his PA. But SB cannae do anything about it for fear of retribution. So, said Barclay, what are we gonna do, eh? Tell the board SB's suit trousers didn't fit him properly because he's wearing a nappy underneath?
Strike didn't smile. The amount of whisky he'd consumed didn't particularly help his mental processes. It was Robin who spoke first.
Well, we can tell the board everything and accept that's going to ruin a few lives. Or we can let them terminate our contract without telling them what's going on and accept that Shifty's going to keep blackmailing SB, or...
Yeah, said Strike heavily. That's the question, isn't it? Where's the third option, where Shifty gets his comeuppance and SB doesn't end up in the Thames?
It sounds, said Robin to Barclay, as though Eleanor would back SB up if he claimed it was just an affair.
Of course, SB's wife mightn't be happy.
Aye, Eleanor would back him up, said Barclay. It's in her interests.
I'd like to nail Shifty, said Strike. That'd please the client no end. If we help them get rid of Shifty without the company's name getting splashed all over the papers, which it definitely will if it gets out their CEO likes having his arse powdered. If that PA's being sexually harassed, Strike said, and watching him do coke at work, why isn't she complaining?
Fear of not being believed, Robin suggested, of losing her job.
Could you, Strike said to Robin, ring Morris for me? He'll still have the girl's contact details. And Barclay, Strike added, getting up from the sofa on the third attempt and heading for the inner office. Come in here. We're going to have to change next week's rotor. Robin can't follow people looking like she just did three rounds with Tyson Fury.
The other two went into Strike's office. Robin stayed sitting at Pat's desk for a moment, thinking not about what Barclay had just told them, but about the moments before he'd arrived, when she and Strike had been sitting in semi-darkness. The memory of Strike telling her she was his best friend made her heart feel immeasurably lightened, as though something she hadn't realized was weighing on it had been removed forever. After a moment's pleasurable savoring of this feeling, she pulled out her mobile and opened the text Morris had sent her earlier. The first, which had the picture attached, said, LOL. The image was of a sign reading, Viagra shipment stolen, cops looking for gang of hardened criminals. The second text said, Not funny?
No, Robin muttered, not funny.
Getting to her feet, she pressed Morris's number and began to clear up the curry one-handed while she held the phone to her ear.
Evening, said Morris, after a couple of rings. Calling to tell me you found a hardened criminal.
Are you driving? Asked Robin, ignoring the witticism.
On foot. Just seen the old folks' home locked up for the night. I'm actually right by the office. I'm on my way to relieve Hutchins. He's outside the Ivy, keeping an eye on Miss Jones's boyfriend.
Well, we need the details of Shifty's PA, said Robin.
What? Why?
We found out what he's blackmailing SB about, but...
She hesitated, imagining the joke she'd have to hear at SB's expense if she told Morris what Eleanor Dean was doing for him. It's nothing illegal, and he's not hurting anyone. We want to talk to Shifty's PA again, so we need her contact details.
No, I don't think we should go back to her, said Morris. Bad idea.
Why? Robin asked, as she dropped the foil tins into the pedal bin, suppressing her frown because it made her bruised face ache.
Because... Fuck's sake, said Morris,
who usually avoided swearing to Robin.
You were the one that said we shouldn't use her.
Behind Robin, in the inner office, Barclay laughed at something Strike had said. For the third time that evening, Robin had a feeling of impending trouble.
Saul, she said, you aren't still seeing her, are you?
He didn't answer immediately. Robin picked up the plates from the desk and put them in the sink, waiting for his answer.
No, of course I'm not, he said, with an attempt at a laugh. I just think this is a bad idea. You were the one who said, before, that she had too much to lose. But we wouldn't be asking her to entrap him or set him up this time. I'll need to think about this, said Morris.
Robin put the knives and forks into the sink, too.
So, this isn't up for debate. We need her contact details.
I don't know whether...